We have a winner in the Robin Golf Sweepstakes, but not without a four-way tie for 42nd place in the Canadian Open, playing a bizarre and outsized role in the outcome, plus a Robiner who works as an external communications point man with both the PGA and the Pac-12, joins us to give his recap of the golf season to date, announces a new twist in the upcoming Robin College Football Sweepstakes, and gives us an update on the most important pants in the world. This is Robin Pod. He is our actual PGA Tour insider, writing and folding the little notes on Jay Monahan's pillow before he falls asleep at night. He's hunted unsuccessfully for physical memorabilia from the last several presidential administrations. He once scaled the shaky tiles of a terracotta roof at midnight in Cabo San Lucas, all in the name of educational freedom. And as we approach the start of wildfire season, he's mercifully about to come out of hibernation. You know him from the standings as Papa Bear. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the managing director of communications firm Bully Pulpit International, one of the leading lights of the Robinverse, Brian McGuigan, joins the pod.
Kamish, it's fantastic to be here. I would go so far as to call it a celebration.
It's a celebration of Robin. It's a celebration of the great game of golf, and it's a celebration of mathematical technicalities. We're recording this just moments after the RBC Canadian Open wrapped up. It was a little bit shaky there down the stretch to see if Bobby Mack was going to hold on to the lead. He did. It was really crowded. We ourselves also had a crowded leaderboard in the Robinverse, which we will get to, but it was so crowded in Toronto, or I should say Hamilton, that we almost thought there was going to be a little nighttime playoff and the evening fog, perhaps. But we avoided that. McIntyre gets the win. Drones be damned. And you and I have a winner to reveal and to congratulate, but not without controversy.
As the British say. I'll say this. It seems like this is your first live or quick reaction pod. Is that correct?
Basically, yeah. Jake and I did a little bit 2 weeks ago, but nothing of this magnitude.
Well, there's certainly a lot to discuss with our leaderboard, as well as what happened up in Canada.
As we referenced earlier, the leaderboard was stacked. There was realistically seven folks that could have made a charge for it. After Friday and Saturday transpired, we began to do some grading. We had to make the cut parlay markets that were graded. We had a few other markets that were graded as well. You could tell mathematically it was pretty much narrowed down to the gentlemen who were 1 and 2 coming into the weekend, and that was Matt Roblitowski and Evan Davis. Evan came in, Evan better hair than Mark Davis because he's bald, for those of you that haven't seen him. So that's why he has better hair. He came in with a 51-point lead with 6 markets left to determine it all. And it looked early on like Matt was going to smoke him. As a erstwhile contestant yourself, I want to get your quick reactions to what it was like out there.
Obviously, a crowded leaderboard at the end of the Canadian Open. Over in Robinland, we also had a crowded leaderboard. I'll put my hand up and freely admit that I was not in contention this Sunday or really any others for several weeks. And I'd love to get into some of my thoughts about what, you know, my MO was going into this Robin season and why it did not succeed later on in this episode. But I do want to call this out, Kamish. Matt, Evan, Chad, DJ, Sarah, others towards the top of the Robin leaderboard, I think did an excellent job this season of identifying the up-and-comers to succeed and win in Robin. Really comes down to being able to identify those up-and-comers, and not just that, but realize which tournaments favor them best. And I think Matt and Evan going down to the end with two of those up-and-comers in final contention on Sunday is a perfect example of that.
We will spare the audience of going market by market to break down how he won, and we will simply move to the official reveal of the winner of the $1,000 grand prize for the 2024 Robin Golf Sweepstakes. And that winner is, in fact, Evan, better hair than Mark Davis, who squeaks out a victory over Matt Rylotowski. I can also reveal for the first time the first nickname ever conceived of and deployed on Robin Pod, and that will be Matt's nickname. He will be referred to henceforth as nothing other than Matt Rylotowski, because his commentary, when he found out how he lost, which we will get into here in a minute, his comments were nothing short of ribald. So congratulations to Evan. Matt, better luck next year. You fought valiantly, as we will discuss. As I mentioned, Evan came into the weekend with a 51-point lead. He came into Sunday with a 51-point lead, because some of the markets were already graded. And there were six markets left to decide it all. And it looked like Matt was going to come out and just take them. Towards the very end of Sunday, it became clear that if McIntyre won, that Evan would win, and that if Griffin won outright, Matt would win. But we were only in this place to begin with because there was a stipulation in the head-to-head matchup parlay market, of which all contestants made two choices. So it's two choices at picking two head-to-head matchups, right? And they both have to win. At least this is how it was described on the card. Unless one of the two head-to-head matchups ties. If one of the two head-to-head matchups ties, you get half the points, right? It's sort of like an actual parlay bet in real life. If you have multiple legs and one of them is a push, then the whole thing is a push. At least you don't lose your money. You get your money back. Well, we don't have any concept of money in Robin or balance allocation or whatnot. So when designing these two categories, the thought was, well, if one of the legs ties and I don't want to completely penalize people, I'll give them half the points. I can't give them negative points, and 0 points is the same as a loss, right? Because we're not allocating a balance in the first place. Evan had both of his head-to-head matchup parlays involve a tie for one of the two legs. So on both of those, he got half points. Together, that amounted to about 82 points. And had he not earned those 82 points, Matt would have won. When designing this sweepstakes, I can't say that I was counting on two pairs separately of golfers to all tie for 42nd and have that be arguably the mathematically decisive factor. But here we are. But I want to, now that our champion has been announced and declared, I do want to turn briefly to how Papa got into the position that he got into, because I'm just scrolling down the standings here as I have them. I'm looking live at the leaderboard, and I see Papa sitting down there at 1682 total points, a far cry from the winning tally of 3233. You and I have a little tradition. Whenever I send out the card, you always text every week, you know, how could I forget the insert tournament name, right? As if to say that, you know, something like the Zurich Classic is absolute must-watch golf, ha-ha. But you actually did forget the Charles Schwab Challenge. And so I'm just wondering how Papa could have actually forgotten, because I've got to think that contributed somewhat to you falling dismally far back in the standings.
I think it's the Wednesday. I think it's the Wednesday cutoff to submit your picks. If I had to choose one reason that I got slipped up throughout the season, it would be that. Unfortunately, I only missed one of those deadlines without submitting my picks. But a lesson learned that I probably need to create a calendar event going forward. I will say that is not the only reason I'm so far back, and no one is as disappointed as I am with how I performed throughout this competition. Let me just give you a little snippet into some of my thinking, specifically around the Canadian Open. So I went long and hard on Sahith for the Canadian Open.
That's a rough play.
Kamish, do you know how Sahith finished?
I don't think they number him that low, because he didn't make the cut.
He did not make the cut. So that is, ladies and gentlemen, a very easy way to not do very well in the Canadian Open. And I will say I've had several of those throughout the course of this competition where I try to pick one horse and ride them, such as a Ben Griffin. But, you know, clearly that worked out for some. It did not work out for me. I had no one like that, unfortunately, throughout the 8 weeks or seven that I fully competed in.
You are not alone. Many people got bitten by the Wednesday bug. It's much different than the Friday night, Saturday morning bug for football, for example. You are not alone there. But this is yet another reason why we're moving to weekly prizes. If you do, in fact, miss a week, you're not out effectively of the only grand prize, or the only prize that you can win, i.e. the grand prize, right? You can still come back the following week and compete for something in a discrete format. You mentioned backing horses. This was a tactic successfully deployed by Rob Letowski, who I'm still honestly kind of shocked didn't come away with this thing. He backed Sam Burns and Mackenzie Hughes this week, for example. Those were the horses that he rode. Burns was good, but didn't quite get it done either in the outright market or the handicap market. And Hughes was right there, but couldn't get it done in the glorious Nation of Canada market. So it's not a bad tactic, right? That's just unfortunately your horses came up a little lame.
Yes, they did. However, I do have a question, Kamish, about some of our, let's call it the second half of the leaderboard.
Sure.
You know, talk to me a bit about the withdrawals.
What really happened with the withdrawals is that was a decision, honestly, perpetrated by myself. And that's because I think that many people, as I mentioned, were caught by the Wednesday bug. And those who withdrew were caught by the Wednesday bug like three times in a row or something, which basically indicated, okay, you're not really doing this anymore. And there is some attrition. If you'll note, last year's college football competition, and I believe the last 2 years in college football, there were the deadline deadbeats highlighted every week, i.e. those who missed the submission deadline. When they did it, they'd be out of the whole contest. When these guys did it, initially, they were not out of the whole contest. That was a rule change that we made. People don't want to be completely penalized for missing 1 week. They're already mathematically penalized. It's almost impossible for them to catch up. You don't need to also automatically boot them out of the contest. But in the withdrawal instance here, we had folks that were just repeatedly doing it. And so I made the executive decision to say they were withdrawn because they were like clearly just not into it anymore. And that's fine. You're always going to get some form of attrition. You know, can't take it personally.
Well, everyone looks forward to the majors, and I'm happy to hear that you're moving to week prizes, or at least adding that as an additional feature going forward. But what I think is that the majors should have special significance if you are considering how to structure week-to-week prizes. Potentially, you could have larger pots for majors, lesser for the others, just to, you know, like the professionals, you know, have something to really look forward to.
How would you feel about a tournament that comprised the larger tournaments that were not necessarily over consecutive weeks? So for example, you could subscribe to Robin content, get entry in the tournament, but you could do that, say, in February, and then instead of, oh, it runs for 10 weeks and it's these consecutive weeks, you know, from A to B, you could say it runs over however many tournaments, but it could be scattered throughout the year so that it's not contiguous. Because unlike you, a lot of people do forget the Zurich Classic or do forget the, you know, Charles Schwab or what have you.
But according to your thinking, they would not forget the U.S. Open. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. If let's say you scattered over the 10 biggest events in golf throughout the year.
So I think that would do a few things. One is it would attract or make it easier, assuming you didn't have auto elimination, such as in the college football competition, it would probably attract a larger pool of contestants, you know, particularly around those peak weekends, around the majors. Because I think that mirrors the way a lot of golf fans consume the sport. They don't necessarily watch week to week. And I'm talking about the casual fan here, which none of us in the existing Robin competition are. If you were watching literally every golf competition week to week. But there are many who just watch the Masters, the PGA, US Open, British Open, and that's it. That is their golf consumption for the season. You know, potentially the Ryder Cup if it's one of those years. So I think this evolution, that evolution of Robin would make it more consistent with how most quote unquote fans consume, while still leaving room for the diehards to compete week to week.
Well, you know, we talked about going to weekly prizes here for golf in the future. We're also going to be going to weekly prizes in college football. And we are officially less than 3 months away from the tournament that started it all, the Robin College Football Sweepstakes Tournament. The $2,500 grand prize for the top finisher at the end of the season is back, but we are also giving away smaller weekly prizes for the top points getter for each week. We're also ditching Google Forms. We're moving things over to Typeform for a better entry experience. But most importantly, if you want to enter, subscribe to Robin's College Football content. Subscriptions don't just get you access to the tournament, but they get you access to all the college football posts on Robin, including our summer game preview series, the Robin Crystal Ball, plus, obviously, the recap posts, the standings, the nicknames, and everything else that you love. And for a limited time, we are taking $10 off that subscription. Go to robinsports.com/earlybird, EARLYBIRD, to take advantage of this offer before August 1st. That's robinsports.com/earlybird for $10 off the full season subscription. We had a few people do this, and they claimed that the link wasn't working, but then when I checked with them, that just they couldn't spell early bird, which, you know.
Was it the bird part that got them tripped up?
Sure, because there's a vowel in bird, right? There's an I in bird, but there's no I in Robin.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, please.
So something I saw during the college football competition was a variety of strategies about how best to succeed. And you know, not every weekend in college football is made the same. And there are some games that you see on the calendar and you want to throw down as many points on that as possible. And there are other weekends where you just want to sit it out and make a low or a safe bet or two and leave it at that.
I didn't hear anything about gambling, did I?
No, certainly not. You can clean that up in post.
Okay. Anyway, as you were saying.
So, Kamish, have you thought about how that the week to week, and I'm talking specifically about football here, but how changing or at least adding week to week incentives would change strategies?
When you say incentives, you mean weekly prizing in addition to grand prizing?
Yes, but it creates an incentive to, you know, potentially be more aggressive than you would otherwise be, right?
Totally. One, it doesn't totally penalize you if you have a case of the Wednesdays. But two, you can go for the gold. Now, I will say we have not yet revealed this, but because you're pressing me into a corner here, I do feel like I have to say this. We will be altering the college football card this year to have it be like the golf card. And what I mean by that is 10 to 12 different decision points. You are not allocating balances or coins or what have you to each decision. It is not going to be like it was in the past. again, probably not very popular. We hope that people will, you know, while they might initially dislike that, they will get along with it over time and they will get used to it. There are many reasons for this, which we will not get into here. So the answer to your question, though, is because of that change, I think all the tactics are going to be altered anyway, but not necessarily in terms of, as you would say, like everybody going all in, you know, because there is no concept going forward of all in because there's no balance that you have to manage.
Wow. This is a significant development in announcement.
And it wasn't scripted. You've pulled it out of me. It's something that is at the very least going to prevent the contest from, in its final weeks, if there's 200 people that play it, in its final weeks having, you know, only three people or something that have any prayer of winning it because their balances are so high. The other thing is that if we did weekly prizes with this format, then every single person would just go all in on one game.
Correct.
So then naturally you would need to say, well, let's have there be two games or three games or four games. Well, that's basically what we're doing. You're just not allocating a balance to it. And so we feel like the prepackaged amount of points that you win, if you make a selection, again, just like in golf, will help mitigate that.
But with college football, you'll stick to teams, right? Rather than doing anything with individuals.
I mean, listen, I know your passion for collegiate quarterback props. With that being said, I think we'll probably stick to teams. Props just kind of feel like gambling, you know? And again, we don't abide by that here in the Robinverse.
That's not what this community is about.
Absolutely not. No. Robin Pod is not brought to you by Temu. Soulless commercialism for soulless people. Temu is paving the way for the CCP to track those hideous yoga pants every move. And by Iranian helicopter services. The U.S. Fed might end up pulling off a soft landing, but we sure won't. Come see why it's okay to make fun of someone dying if they're the leader of one of America's enemies. By Skippers. You probably didn't remember we existed, did you? Well, now that Red Lobster's bankrupt, we're the worst thing left, and it's our shrimp's time to shine. By Wells Fargo. All the big banks are terrible, but there's one you probably think is worse than the rest because you happen to have had a horrible experience with them. Well, if Wells Fargo isn't that bank for you, let's change that. Come on in and let our militantly incorrect 23-year-old tellers make you want to kill yourself. And speaking of, by Boeing. If all the whistleblowers are dead, then there's nothing left to really talk about, is there? So stop asking questions and get back to flying today with Boeing.
So it is actually fitting that you're making significant transformations to the Robin College Football Competition in a year that I think will be marked by significant developments in college football itself.
I mean, last week's podcast was hopefully illustrative on this, not so much from my end, but more from the innovator, Evan Nobie Williams, from his end, because he covers this day in and day out in big media, shall we say. And I mean, I thought his analysis was pretty spot on in the sense that, yes, there's a ton of change behind the scenes. The change isn't even close to being over. It will probably get weirder and uglier before it gets better. But a lot of the change is on the wrapping paper. It's not within the present itself. A lot of the change is somewhat surface and circumstantial when it comes to what does it actually feel like to engage with college football as a product. So he tamed me a little bit, and that I think I was more on the side of old man yells at kids to get off lawn, doesn't like change. And I think his points were pretty illustrative on that. So I look in the short term for more of the same. However, nothing will ever prepare me for a UCLA Penn State conference game no matter how hard I tried.
I think I'm still at where you were before that conversation, but there's just something off about an Oregon game against Michigan in the Big House on November 2nd that I'm not sure I'm prepared for and will feel different, very, very different than any other college football season I've ever followed.
Are you prepared for the Apple Cup and the Civil War in mid-September?
No. And you know, like I think, you know, speaking of those two schools, for a moment, you have Washington State and Oregon State. You know, they will have, you know, maybe taken a step down. At least the perception is that they have taken a step down.
Well, everyone left.
Right.
The janitor left. Like, everyone is gone.
So I don't think that they, you know, not to speak for their fans, but, you know, my perception of them is that, you know, they're in a fundamentally different place. And college football for them is significantly different in 24 than it was in 23 or in years before that. And so, you know, yes, you know, as an Oregon fan, it will be cool, interesting, entertaining, and hopefully rewarding to follow Oregon in the Big Ten this year. But I do so with significant hesitation because I think even though Oregon benefited potentially from a lot of this turnover, I don't think it will feel the same. It's going to be a very difficult college football season, I think. And maybe we get to the end of it and say it was all worth it. But you know, that remains to be seen for me right now.
There's the optics of will Oregon at Ohio State in mid-October feel the same, which obviously it won't. But then there's also the idea of now we're bastardizing athlete compensation to basically bribe the best recruits to go to the schools with the most money, and we're all doing it out in the open. So when I watch a school with a player that was one of those players, do I care? Does that somehow sour me that this great player that's going to be on the field, maybe a star quarterback for a team, for example, was obviously purchased, right? Now, obviously, there's also been some of that in the past. The game is not without that, and we all know that. Am I prevented from enjoying something because now I know that we're just doing out-and-out bribery? But it's in the name, it's in the quote-unquote spirit of compensating an athlete from several years ago that isn't even in college anymore that was treated unfairly as decided by a court of law.
I completely agree with you. I think you're going to see ratings continue to increase, for example, and other indicators that show that, you know, that all this transformation is successful and that, you know, people want to watch more college football played at a higher level with the best athletes and the best venues. However, as a fan, I think you and I both know, and others listening to this pod, that we will come to a situation likely later in the season where there are teams that succeed and are in position to either win the national championship, get into the playoffs, win bowl games, win conferences, where there will be commentary, a not insignificant amount of commentary, that raises the point that this is a fake team, that this is a team that has been assembled, that this wasn't a program that was built up. It was, you know, bought and paid for. And that is the phase of this that I'm the least looking forward to. And, you know, given that I'm an Oregon fan, I hope Oregon is successful in the Big Ten and goes off to the playoffs and is able to compete there. But I know that that success will come with the cost of me as an Oregon fan having to defend Oregon as a program from, you know, friends who are not Oregon fans and just looking to make that point.
Most people come at it from the angle that you come at it, which is you are a fan of a program. You see the sport through the lens largely of the program of which you're a fan. I'm in the minority that didn't go to an undergraduate school that has FBS football. I just love the sport for the sport. And on one hand, you might think that that would make me not as susceptible to feeling weird or bad in any way about the changes going on because I don't have any rival fan bases to defend my team against because I don't have a team. I just enjoy watching all of it. It's kind of what allows me to even put on sweepstakes about the sport, right? I'm not ever going to try to bias coverage towards one team or conference or side of the country because I just don't really care. But on the other hand, the people that will defend this in large part will defend the changes in the game through the lens of how it helps or hurts their program. And a lot of the major programs, this is going to, at least at times, help their program. I don't have any lens through which I see the direct benefits of it either. I'm looking at it in totality because I don't have those allegiances. And so I go back and forth on whether how this perception or this vantage point of my fandom should affect how I feel about it. I'm not thrilled by it. And I would say at this point, how quickly can we get to the Super League? That would at least make it somewhat more palatable because then we're getting rid of the mirage that South Alabama is competing for the same championship as Alabama.
And I think we can all say with some confidence that this is where it's heading. I just think in this transition phase that it's going to be where you have all the passions of different fan bases coming together in the change, to the schedule, plus how players come into programs. It's going to be that passion is going to result in a lot of commentary about the parts of the sport that, are just tough, particularly where you have things where you have an Oregon team that, has had a lot of success recently. The program has had a lot of success, but, I would be the first to admit that they have benefited, potentially more than just about any other program in the country as a result of NIL. And that to me, I'm talking strictly as a fan trying to grapple with all that and think about how I'm going to feel this season, going to be a tough aspect if Oregon is successful. And if they aren't, then I'm going to have, equally difficult thoughts about, what this was all for.
The way you're talking about it, it strikes me as college football is like the kid going through mid-stage puberty that nobody wants to be around because they're just a nightmare. I feel like that's what we're in right now, right? Yeah. They'll never be the same kid that they were again. And frankly, they weren't that kid for a long time in the last several years anyway. But they're also not the thing that they're going to grow into is also not what they are right now. So we're in this inevitable, unchangeable, transitory phase where you're not a child, but you're not an adult, and you're just pissing everybody off.
I'm over here crying.
Something else that made you cry when it wasn't making you, I assume, laugh from the absurdity of it all was the demise of the Pac-12. Much as you are an outside consultant to the PGA on the communication side of things, you held a similar role working outside of the Pac-12 with the conference itself when all this was happening. And you had a really front row seat to the end of it all, right as the ship was sort of bubbling under the water. Among the many things I want to ask you about this, and I know that there's a lot that you can't share, but the executives involved from the TV networks to the conferences to the school presidents, everyone seemed absurd. Was having a front row seat to that experience as surreal and absurd as it felt to those of us on the outside just reading the everyday news?
There were terrible decisions made at the Pac-12 and among the member universities, and probably some mismanagement as well. But also, there are larger forces at play. I think certainly the Pac-12 could have lasted for period of time, you know, well into, if not through, its next media contract, if it was able to secure one. But ultimately, incentives drew some of those schools away. They took first mover advantage to secure larger revenue streams in different conferences, and the rest is history. So it's complicated, but ultimately, I don't believe that the Pac-12 would have lasted forever in this current environment, and I feel the same way about several other current Power Five conferences as well. It was ultimately about the media and the networks and the producers and business folks at Fox and ESPN who made decisions, plural, that put Oregon State and Washington State in the position that they ended up in. And, you know, certainly there are, you go around and talk to different people and you get, we'll get in the know and you'll get different answers as to what those decisions were. But ultimately, if you look at the Pac-12, 10 of the 12 made it into other Power Five conferences successfully. So why were two left on the sidelines? It was about, you know, their location in the United States, that they were in rural communities, removed from major media markets. And ultimately, when it came around to once the Pac-12 had fully demised, and the question was, you know, where would Oregon State and Washington State end up? They were not attractive to other Power Five conferences, largely because they weren't attractive to media executives.
What did you learn from that experience about what's in store for college football more broadly?
The word that I have always found to be amusing is realignment, because realignment means different things to different people. But to the people who were involved in the realignment process, fundamentally what it means is realigning a product for television and media distribution. It is not realigning schedules and which conferences schools are in. It is looked at a product basis and a media market basis. And so if you were to ask me, what do you see coming ahead in the world of college sports? I would say mass realignment that doesn't just touch football, but begins to go into other sports as well, including and especially basketball. If the ACC goes down, I think you're going to see a similar situation where you have schools in rural communities that are left behind.
Just like there's so much going on with college sports, there's also so much going on with the future of professional golf. The way that both entities, PGA and LIV, discuss it, it seems as if the appearances that they prefer to put out into the world are that there is going to be some quasi happily ever after merger, synergy, banding together. That was certainly what the announcement was several months ago. Are we still on track for that? Is that realistic in your mind? Or is this all just stalling for time, window dressing? There's too many conflicting priorities from those involved, and it ultimately ends up fading away.
Well, everyone behind the scenes is working hard to try to make that outcome realistic and possible and the final outcome. But it's tough. And I think what's lost in all the noise is the reasons why it is tough and difficult. You know, strictly as a financial matter, this isn't a merger. It's an investment that the PIF, the Public Investment Fund, the backers of LIV, would make into the PGA Tour. But really, this is about product and the product that ends up emerging after a deal is a tough, complex subject, because you're talking about golfers, number one, you're talking about schedule, number two, you're talking about venues, number three, you're talking about media rights, number four. I could go on and tally up to well into the 20s about the different factors that have to be considered about what this product ultimately looks like post a deal. And that just takes time. No one wants to get it wrong. And getting it right takes time to build consensus, get buy-in, run the numbers. I think the work is being done. I see the work being done, and I think that there will be a positive outcome, but it doesn't work on the timeline that golf fans and golf media and everyone else want it to, which is, you know, just tell us this thing is over and we're moving on.
Who do you think, from the players' perspective, are the right people to be leading these discussions and leading with their input to forge some sort of complicated consensus? Because I don't think they think it's Rory.
Well, Rory was on the policy board and resigned late last year. You know, currently you have six players on the policy board and on the enterprises board. Without going too far into the weeds, there are two boards. You know, one is over the nonprofit, another is over the newly formed commercial entity, PGA Tour Enterprises, which oversees all the business, including this deal or potential deal and transaction with PIF. So all those player directors led by Tiger Woods are deeply involved. Tiger Woods himself is negotiating with PIF along with the CEO of the PGA Tour and Commissioner Jay Monahan and other independent directors. So they've got the right group together to conduct these negotiations. At the end of the day, there will be a deal on the table. And whether that deal is accepted or not is going to be up to, you know, the people in that room on that board, as well as, you know, those players feeling that they have the consensus of the larger PGA Tour membership.
We included LIV on the card for a couple of weeks this year. Do we need to include LIV going forward in a broader sense for next year's Robin Golf Sweepstakes?
I think the question is whether anyone knows what's going on the LIV Tour right now. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean that seriously. I just, my sense from you know, a golf fan standpoint is that a lot of people are not following along. They don't understand the format. They know the players very well. And when you have the majors and you have Bryson show up and do well, people are happy to see that. But Bryson goes back to LIV and into a black hole. And so I wonder your thoughts, Kamish, on that question. Like, if you were to open up picks, the question for you would be, you know, if you move forward with that, like, do you think that you would have a competition filled with people who were sophisticated enough to know what was going on LIV Golf?
So we did a few worry less, LIV more specialty markets on the card for some LIV. I believe they were outright winner. One was an outright winner for Singapore, and I think we had a team winner in another week for Adelaide. And no one complained about it, but we don't also get a ton of feedback on the card either, I'll be honest. I also have to say, just as a blanket statement, this was the first directly paid tournament via subscriptions or free method of entry that we have even done. So a lot of what was going on here with the 20 to 30 of you that did participate, withdrawals notwithstanding, was that, you know, we were just testing to see if the lights worked, you know, and some of that was also testing out LIV stuff in the card. So not a huge sample size of feedback to know if people really reacted positively to those markets, because at least with the majors, you'll get the LIV players involved, right?
Yeah, but then you have to go to the team format. I mean, maybe not have to, but, you know, that's a central aspect to LIV Golf. And clearly people know the players, but do they know the teams?
Right.
And how the teams are performing.
That's right. Where you lose them. Yeah. No, that's totally like, who's, what the hell is Scorpions? Like, I feel like I'm in Arena Football too.
And so I think it would be one thing if it was focused on the players, and another if it was focused on the team. If I remember the questions correctly from this year, you had asked at least one question about the teams. And I, even though I follow all of this stuff closely, I had to pause and think about who was on each of those teams.
One of the majors that we'll be emphasizing, obviously, I think in the future, at a bare minimum, we had two. We had the Masters and the PGA. When they moved the PGA to May, that fit really well for us. But we'll also for sure have at least the U.S. Open next year. And we have way too early U.S. Open predictions out there. We have Scotty is a 4-1 favorite. And then we have a major log jam between 12-1 and 16-1 with Rory, Xander, Rahm, Victor, Brooks, and Ludwig. Wyndi Clark at 28-1. What happened to him? He was right there. He had his number two win, arguably the most dominant golf run of any golfer, you know, in the last, 20 years was going on. So he was an easy victim to get lost in that large of a shadow. But you just don't really hear about him like you did even last year.
I think right now golf is looking for a number two. You have Scotty, who's the clear number one. And so the question everyone is asking is, who's going to step up and compete with Scotty week to week? What I think all of golf would like is for there to be a clear number two who, without question, was always going to be in the mix with Scotty. And that's what we had at the Players this year. We had that tournament go down to the wire. We had Scotty, we had Xander, and we had Wyndham at the end. And of course, Wyndham had a chance to tie and it holed out. And ever since then, Wyndham is he's struggled. That being said, Xander, who was also in the mix towards the end of the Players, he's been consistent, and he just won at Valhalla a couple of weekends ago. And so I wonder if we haven't given him enough appreciation. And I'm curious to see specifically how he does at the U.S. Open this year.
You know who else isn't competing with Scottie Scheffler anymore?
Who's that?
The Louisville Police Department. We have one piece of footage, another piece of audio. Walk us through how we went from he can't even play this week because he's got a court date tomorrow. We're saying this on Sunday, about Monday, June 3rd. How we went from that to the charges are dropped, the officer is being disciplined, and the video shows that the claims are at best suspect.
Something that stood out to me immediately, and maybe resonates with anyone else who's been to a professional golf tournament, is these are all chaotic scenes in terms of entry and exit. And I think generally the tournaments do a good job of providing as many entries and exits as possible. But generally speaking, those are on foot. And so there are a limited number of entry and exit points for vehicles. And of course, the players drive in to the course and leave in a car. And not just any car. Most of these cars are donated by Mercedes, BMW, other luxury auto manufacturers. Provide a fleet of 60 BMWs, 100 BMWs for players to use. These cars are not discreet. They may blend in on the road, but around the tournament, you can tell that there's clearly someone of importance in this vehicle who has permission to drive it. And I didn't see that fully recognized in all the commentary about an analysis of what happened. But I think that's important to think about, that generally at most tournaments, if you're in one of these vehicles, you have some special permissions, right? Like Scotty came out and said, this is a big misunderstanding. I think that was the foundation of it, that this police officer may have not recognized the vehicle. It, you know, we can talk about the video. It did look dark out. That Scotty thought, you know, based on all the other tournaments he's been to and his ability, you know, in those type of vehicles to just drive on up through traffic, around traffic, that was something he was allowed to do in this instance. Clearly, the Louisville Police Department had a different opinion about that, which led to the incident itself. Then we come to, the incident happens. You know, everyone's trying to make sense of it. You have ESPN, who is there, who had some initial reporting, which I will say turned out to be accurate. The video that came out afterwards is from a street cam. We also have some police footage, body cam footage.
Although not the officer's body cam footage, other body cam footage.
Other officers post arrest. And if you put all of these pieces together, ESPN's reporting, the street cam and body cam, a picture starts to emerge where this is just a big miscommunication for starters. But then I think the street cam is the most interesting tell of them all, because you can't see that much, but what you can see is enough to say that Scotty did not see this officer. Thought he was in this official vehicle, and given all these other tournaments he's been in similar vehicles, able to just cut the line and drive on up to the clubhouse.
And no one was being dragged. The verb drag was used many times.
Yes,
my two favorite verbs in the one paragraph long police statement were dragged and destroyed. The officer was the object that was allegedly dragged. And the pants were the object that were allegedly destroyed, as we memorialized in the title of our first podcast, the debut Robin podcast, actually 2 weeks ago.
What I saw in this street cam footage was more of a lunge, and certainly not a drag, but a lunge to try to hit or strike the vehicle to get Scotty's attention. Now, in that process, is it possible he damaged his pants? Potentially, but where? Where were the pants damaged? When you use the word drag, it strikes the visual of, you know, the person being tangled in the car and being pulled along with it. That's not what I saw in that street cam footage.
Do we know? Has anyone seen the pants? Because this is now an artifact of professional golf.
I couldn't agree more. And we do have an update to some degree. I don't know if you caught it this week, but after the charges were dismissed, the detective Brian Gillis issued a statement. Did you see this?
I heard that there was a two-part statement from the officer.
Yes. So there was the top part is in the form of a letter where it says, "Hey, this is all a big misunderstanding. You know, we figured this out. We're moving on. Wish Scotty the best." But there was a PS on the bottom. So if I can indulge you, I'd like to read that.
One might say a pants script.
P.S. dot, dot, dot. Yes, the department has us buying freaking $80 pants. To those concerned, they were indeed ruined. But Scotty, it's all good. I would never have guessed I'd have the most famous pair of pants in the country for a few weeks because of this. Take care and be safe, Brian. So in this statement, he confirms that the parents were ruined. Again, how they were ruined, I hope is something that we will find out one day.
Sure.
But I definitely agree with this section where he says, I would have never guessed I'd have the most famous pants in the country for a few weeks because of this. I disagree with a few weeks. These are fundamentally famous pants now that have some value attached to them.
Sure. 1,000%. He doubled down on saying they were ruined. They can't be destroyed beyond repair and ruined. And also he has the hottest pants That sounded weird, but you know what I mean. If they're destroyed beyond repair, you can't even hold them. There's nothing. They're just in tatters, right? They weren't destroyed beyond repair. There's no way. And I think we saw that in the video.
Right. And I think ruined is, you know, it can take many forms. We would.
Perhaps his ego was ruined.
We would need to see these pants to know for sure.
Can you get the pants? Do you? I mean, you know people.
But, you know, this raises a topic of, like, there are so many other types of sports memorabilia or artifacts that fall into this category. Let's take playing cards, right? I think that's how most people, their entry point into this realm. You have playing cards that, you know, such as Jordan's rookie playing card that can go for a significant amount of money. But then you have items such as these pants. You have the Steve Bartman baseball.
Sure.
Right? Okay.
Sure.
Which was famously purchased and incinerated because of the bad luck associated with that, which apparently worked. The Cubs went on to later win a World Series. And I just think that these pants will live to see another day. Maybe not in use, but certainly framed. That's I'm picturing something that's framed on a wall with these pants in them.
Would they not fly them at half mast at Valhalla every year during the PGA Championship?
Nothing would surprise me at this point. I think most people involved in this incident would just like to move on. However, Detective Gillis has a very valuable collector's item on his hand. And I don't know what all the rules are associated with this, but you know, you could definitely envision a scenario one day where he's left the Louisville Police Department and auctions those off to the highest bidder.
Now, you have, before we finish, you have another tale about another great artifact that you expressly wish to disclose to the Robinverse.
So I do. And when I was thinking about these pants and, you know, seeing these pants as a collector, potential collector's item, my mind went to all sorts of other artifacts that fall into this realm. I mentioned the Steve Bartman baseball, but I lived in DC for a while. And when I first got to DC in 2008, I had friends who worked on Capitol Hill, and they told me a story that the famous Mission Accomplished banner that hung up behind President Bush on the aircraft carrier was on display in a garage somewhere around Capitol Hill. Now, when you want to talk about something that has value, I can only imagine what the Mission Accomplished banner would go for in an open auction.
There's lore. There's lore there.
I was thinking, you know, when these pants came up, that, you know, obviously it was, you know, people were looking at the pants, were like, well, we got to see to understand what happened here, like what's going on. And the question is that I immediately jumped to, is Detective Gillis going to hang on to these pants and hide them like these people who allegedly had the Mission Accomplished banner? Or is he going to do something else with them, sell them, auction them off, put them on display, loan them out? Or you have the ass section ripped, which is embarrassing.
The ass is ripped?
Yes.
You've thought about this more than I have, man.
But technically, the pants are ruined.
Did you ever find the Mission Accomplished banner?
No, never. I asked. I sought it out. I think like these pants, if you told me I was in a city and they were framed and on a wall somewhere, I would go out of my way right now to go to that place. Similar to other great artifacts in sports history.
Then we'll have to end the pod in the collective solace that your mission, Papa, is still ongoing.
It is.